Jerry, it looks like you have something as well.
Yeah, this is an article entitled The Partition Plan, 62 Years After, by Ariella Azule. The United Nations Partition Decision of 29th November 1947 was adopted in complete opposition to the desires of the country's Arab inhabitants, who were at least 70% of the population. A not insignificant number of Jews also opposed the decision. From the moment that the UN decided, the Zionist leadership counted the country's inhabitants along to the line dividing the Jews from the Arabs. The opposition of the Zionist leadership in support of partition and its unconditional justification of using violence to establish the Jewish regime were presented as the Jewish position. Ultra-Orthodox Jews, communist pacifists, and those who supported the creation of a civil society had no place in the public discourse, and almost no information is available about their struggle. This erasure is also the outcome of the action of the state apparatus as it took over public discourse, the discourse of female and male citizens, and organized the totality of relationships among the country's inhabitants according to the destructive ethnic divisions between Jews and Arabs. The Arabs who lived in Palestine for hundreds of years, occupying more than 90% of the territory, opposed from the outset the plan to partition their land and refused to cooperate with the UN bodies that prepared it. The partition plan, therefore, was designed by the UN and the Zionist leadership, which thereby gained recognition as the leadership of the state in information. The country's Arab inhabitants had little influence given the lineup of forces. First of all, is the Jewish state in information and organizations of states, and the UN, which supported it. New diplomatic, military, and political map that was created transformed them into stateless persons, that is, the Palestinians. The UN decision was a crucial moment in transforming the Arabs from inhabitants of their country into stateless persons, nor was there any other state which did. The reasons and rationale behind the opposition of the majority of the country's inhabitants to the partition plan received almost no attention. In a situation where there was room only for only two competing stories, which were presented as if they both sprang from the same initial conditions, their logic was understood as an example of irrational policy or as their story. Palestinians were presumed to as having missed the opportunity that had been given to them, as having made a continuous series of errors: mass flight, hostile action, cooperating with the attack by Arab states. The Jews, on the other hand, were presented as seizing the opportunity presented and knowing how to make the most of it. Today, 62 years after the partition plan divided the residents of the country, Jews and Arabs from each other, restricting them to into two hostile national ethnicities, the time has come to critically re-examine the calamity to which it led and to consider how it might be possible for all the country's inhabitants, those who immigrated throughout the years and those who were expelled in order to create a state only for some, to create a regime in their own image, the image of a heterogeneous society which will know how to celebrate its religious and national holidays in private and free the state from the burden of nationality so that it can prosper as a civil society. Ariella Azule teaches political philosophy and visual culture at the Hermeneutics and Cultural Studies, Bar-Ilan University, and is the author of Constituent Violence, 1947 to 1950, and The Civil Contract of Photography. And that was an article about the conditions in Palestine at the time of partition. This article was just brought into the studio by the guest that we have in the studio this afternoon, Rula Awad Rafferty. Rula, welcome back to Peace Radio, and thanks for bringing that article.
Well, thank you, Jerry, for reading that. She is very courageous, and she is very articulate and very outspoken, which is really necessary, especially when you see the heavy burden that keeps going, and if you don't examine the situation, it will keep going on and on and on. Mm-hmm. And actually, this story about the people who have been displaced and dispossessed does reach us here in Idaho. We are, as it reaches all parts of the world, it's so easy sometimes to isolate oneself and say it's out there, it's, they can deal with it. But when the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003, of course, that caused a lot of issues, a lot of, you know, it's war. War is ugly. It doesn't matter however way you look at it. There are costs, human costs. There are environmental costs. There are all kinds of costs. And that invasion resulted in many refugees. Amongst those refugees, now we see many Palestinian refugees. Those are people who have been displaced in 1948, 1947, 48. And so they've been displaced in all over the in many different areas. And of course, they become stateless. So meaning you don't have the papers to go and acquire certain types of jobs. Your kids have to go and learn in United Nations Relief Agency kinds of schools. And it's a very difficult situation. Some of those individuals, many individuals lived in Iraq, some in Baghdad itself, some in whatever refugee camps. However, with the 2003 war, U.S. war in Iraq, and the displacement of people, the stateless then become the last to find refuge. As people escape to Jordan, on the borders between Jordan and Iraq, the Palestinian refugees were put in tents again. They are unable to leave that border area to go. And if they had to go into the Jordan or into any other places, they are escorted with military police or other places. The same thing, there is a group that has been settled in the Al Walid refugee camp, which is on the border of Iraq and Syria, and they've been there for a while. And this is the group that we are seeing. They are now being brought into the U.S.
Some in Idaho, actually.
And it's very important for us that we open, we assessed, we help, not only out of being philanthropists, etc. It's part of our human responsibility.
Sure. Yeah.
Whether we supported the war or not, this is an outcome of it. This is the least we can do. There are those families, especially when they come with refugee, under refugee status, it is, they really don't get the assistance that we sometimes think that we, that they get. They get assistance. I'm so proud that the U.S. is finally hosting some of the refugees, some of the Palestinian refugees from Al Walid refugee camp. However, I just heard that when they are given food stamps, for example, food stamps, you can't buy toilet paper and soap with food stamps. Mm-hmm. They, when you get $40 for a family for what's the time? Is it a month or 3 months? As your money.
Right. It's not enough to live on.
I think even a teenager probably gets more pocket money than that in a month. I mean, it's so.
Lula, let me interrupt just for a second and give once again this phone number in Boise, because there is an active group in Boise that is helping Palestinians. So if you're, I gave the number last hour, but let me give it again. It is 208-230-1150, or contact me, Sally Perrine, at 88. What's my phone number? I just switched it. Well, probably just sperrine@potlatch.com is my email. sperrine@potlatch.com, and you can and I can put you in touch with the folks in Boise that are that are helping out. Sorry to interrupt.
Really. No, not at all. And it's interesting. I mean, you've told the story of Alia and her two kids, and you know, I can't imagine finally being destitute and displaced again into the refugee camp. Your husband gets kidnapped and killed, and you are a young woman with two children, 5 and 7 year old. It is scary. I don't know the trauma that those children can are facing now. We are thinking, we are collecting some material. We are thinking, my husband and I, of driving to Boise perhaps this Friday or this coming weekend.
Okay. And then, well, so apparently a lot of what they need are books, toys, and art supplies for the kids.
And certainly
cosmetics, toilet paper, soap, shampoo, that
clothes,
sort of thing.
Clothes, iron, a bus pass, books for the kids. We are also collecting other things. You know, it's...
Blankets, pillows.
It's cold here. Coming from the Middle East, it's cold here. And so to think about, you know, the winter is coming. Mm-hmm. Also, even if you live in a rural agrarian society in the Middle East, there's a lot more people. So probably there's a need for social contact of some sort.
Sure.
Here people are more, I mean, we like people, but we are more into, you know, smaller groups. And we don't,
and 2.5 kids.
Yeah, and we don't really, we feel that maybe we are intruding when we ask people how they are doing, etc. Mm-hmm. Please do ask, go visit, talk. Extend yourself. Take the kids for a game, make that possible and affordable to them. Mm-hmm. And there is also, this is only one of many, 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 many. I think there's more like that 1,400 people or more. Alauda, which stands for the Palestinian Right to Return Coalition in the U.S., it's, and many community activists and organizations are working very, very hard to support the resettled Palestinian refugee families across the U.S. And they have a very common request, a desire to be able to there is a desire to be able to communicate with one another.
Mm-hmm.
Even when you live in a refugee camp, let's say in on the borders between Syria and Iraq, you develop those relationship with other people who may have come from other hometowns.
Sure.
But then that in that place, it doesn't matter how ugly it is to the external eye, it is a place that brought them together. And so there's this desire to continue that conversation. Sometimes when people resettle, although every possible effort perhaps is made to maintain a whole family together, it doesn't always happen. So there's a lot of fractured families. So the common request is that if people are able to purchase maybe some cheaper computers, etc. There's an internet connection. There is a wish list on Amazon.com. The address, I'm going to give you the whole address for that. Of course, the HTTP /www.amazon, that's amazon.com/GP/registry, that is registry, /wishlist/1, and now everything is going to be capitals. So it's one back after wish list, /1E435, V as in Victor, M as in mom, another M as mom, YKOFR, /ref=CM. /SW/SU/W. So probably you can also find that from emailing office@al-awda.org.
And this is an opportunity for people to donate and for and for the list of things that are
a long list, like they have blankets. There's on that list, I noticed a lot of blankets.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed sometimes like dishes,
mm-hmm.
Bedding. There's a lot. And the people who come from the Al Walid refugee camp literally come back here with nothing. The clothes on their back. Right. That's it. And so anything that is being done. And Al Awda, by the way, the Palestinian Right to Return Coalition, is a not-for-profit, tax-exempt, educational and charitable 501c3 organization as defined by the Internal Revenue Service of the USA. So under IRS guidelines, your donation to PRRC are tax-deductible. And so that's very important to also know.
So, Rula, when you were back, you visited a while ago for the first time in your home for the first time in
42
years.
Yeah, we'll call it 40.
40 years.
42 years.
A few decades.
A few decades, yep.
Did you get to any of these refugee camps when you were there?
We actually went to two. Mm-hmm, we went to the Taisha refugee camp, which is in Bethlehem, and we went to refugee camp in Nablus as well.
Uh-huh.
And Balata refugee camp, that's the one. Wow. And I in Tulkarm, I just walked by the Tulkarm refugee camp.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are, even within the West Bank, there are refugee camps for the people who have been displaced in 1948
internally,
and their offsprings.
Internally
so
within the country.
Within Israel, there is some internally displaced people. So let's say they were moved out of one area and they escaped and they now live in Haifa, Raqqa, or whatever, in Tamra, in their own small ghettoized neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
By international law, it's really important. Those people were provided 1 square kilometer with tents, and then the tent changed into a one-room home, and people were able to build on top of it or extend, so the whole family can. And we met with the some people who said, you know, they talked about living their life and growing up in those very small places. The refugee camp had a chain link fence and had a gate. And when the area was still under occupation in the West Bank, actually the gate was also, sometimes it was controlled that nobody can leave the refugee camp. Even nowadays, when we were there, the refugee camp was invaded by Israeli troops. Although it's the one at Dehesh refugee camp and Balata.
Mm-hmm.
We know that in Balata, everybody has a relative in jail, in the Israeli jails, I mean, or injured.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting because some of the mural that we saw, it had people with amputated legs and it had, but it had a ramp in the refugee camp itself. Everything is built. There is barely any outdoor room for kids to play soccer, but whatever that room is available, the kids were playing soccer. Mm-hmm. There is a strong connection to the land, and so people always wanted to plant things.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see many of those container plantings, and even if it was like 10 square inch, literally, with a planter, and that goes, it's a grapevine that goes from the first floor to the second floor to the third floor, and so it creates some kind of a pergola on the roof.
Uh-huh,
so
uh-huh.
It's I think just looking at that, there is this sentiment about the connection to the land. There is something alive in the place.
Sure.
People develop very strong relationships there.
Sure.
And they write the names of the villages where they came from, or the so to keep that alive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You were recently in Chicago.
Yeah.
And did a panel discussion with two other people.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that? We'll hopefully play some audio from that.
Sure.
Next week. But
sure.
I would love to hear your.
Sure,
your
it was
account of.
Yeah, it was an awesome experience. Truly, we were invited.
Sponsored by the American Friends Service Committee.
Yes,
wonderful organization.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So they, it was. We were invited by the American Friends Service Committee. I've written a reflection that was published at Zuchrot, which means it's Hebrew. It means remembering in the feminine form, about finding my mother's erased village, and so they had. They got a hold of that, and then they were interested in looking at this, acknowledging the past and building a landscape for a future reconciliation. And so we had, it was sort of a speaking tour. We had 3 speaking engagements. The people who participated are Ethan Bronstein, who is the director and founder of Zuchrot, which is an Israeli organization, was founded in 2002. It seeks to educate Jewish Israelis about the Nakba, which is a catastrophe, or the which refers also to 1948 dispossession of the Palestinians. Myself, I'm Palestinian, American. My mother was born in Kula, which is in the 1948 area, and she was. About a year old when they were displaced and dispossessed of that place. And Ali Abu Nama, of course, he's well known. He's the author of One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. And he contributed to numerous written volumes and co-founder of the Electronic Intifada, which is an award-winning online publication about Palestine and Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And he is a staff at the University of Chicago. And so we had three engagements. And this this whole tour was co-sponsored, which was really impressive. It was co-sponsored by the American Friends Service Committee, by Students for Justice in Palestine at DePaul University, at University of Illinois in Chicago, at Northwestern and University of Chicago and Benedictine, as well as Jewish Voice for Peace of Chicago. And so to have that phenomenal.
So Jewish and Palestinian.
Oh, of course.
Of course. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so.
Which I think sometimes we don't.
You don't
realize that there are voices on both sides of this issue for peace and for reconciliation.
Absolutely. Yeah. Uh-huh. Like the article that you read, Jerry, Ariella is a Jewish Israeli. And I mean, that is her stance. Sure. So when we were in Chicago, we our first evening was to speak at the Jewish Voice for Peace event. We had a phenomenal group of people there, individuals interested in learning about, first, about the curriculum that was established by Zuchro to teach about the Nakba. Of course, it's not in the public schools. However, they worked with about 200 or 300 school teachers on articulating it and bringing a lot of the Palestinian narratives into it, because to them, this is part of their own history as well. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, it, denying it means denying part of their own history. We met with Rabbi Brent Rosen. Was a phenomenal figure that I've always wanted to meet him. I have admired his stance on Gaza and many of his very moral stance on many issues. We met several people. Actually, somebody asked me if I'm Greek Orthodox because she wanted to interview me for the newsletter for her group, which really made me think about how sometimes we still try to support from our own whatever
our own perspective
groups and trying to find that niche. Sure. Although we think globally in terms of human rights, we like to find this kind of niche, and I'm not. So, but I said I'll be for that day. Doesn't anyways. And so that was a phenomenal presentation. Speaking there, just and showing some images from Kula, I got a present. My friend Ethan and his girlfriend have gone to Kula the day before. He came there and brought me a stone from my mother's, from the place where she was born, where the actual remains of the house that was demolished. And that was amazing, with a little videotape, and it was really powerful. Speaking about that particular experience, speaking about, because it's one experience for me, but also for Ethan was there, and his reaction, and how he's witnessing something that happens to both of us together at the same place became extremely important, became a driving force. So that memory of the place is decolonized for him. Just now it's not an urban warfare training ground, which is the case actually with many of the demolished and erased villages. They are used as urban warfare training areas. But now it is a home for a friend, so which is really important. So that was our when we get a youth advocate who came and talked about how that particular story resonated with her father's story, who was a Holocaust survivor. That gave me goosebumps, actually, to even think of that. And
it does
And it was really powerful. Her brother and sister have gone back to Poland. She doesn't think that she has the courage to do that, but it's very different there, too. But the next day, we spoke at an Islamic school for girls, grades 9 through 12. And again, I mean, it was really powerful, the transformation, because they get people who are Jewish as to give lectures and talk as part of the interfaith coalition, but they've never had a Jewish Israeli in the school. And so there was worry about, oh, are we going to now think that, oh, all Israelis are like this? Are we going to hear some propaganda? Are we going to hear our history explained away? And it was not. Mm-hmm. I could see the body language of those students melt, the body language from being closed off, I don't want to hear you because right. you are my colonizer, you are the one who kicked me out of there and you are mm-hmm. standing to tell me. And Ethan gave him a lecture or a lesson about how he teaches about the Nakba. All of a sudden, he is acknowledging their history, using the terminology, talking about Palestine, talking about the 800,000 people who lived in the area now known as Israel in the pre-partition area. And in 48, it went down to about 100,000. And that was due to military violence and due to mm-hmm. expulsion. And that acknowledgement was powerful, especially for students who are always, they only know that through their own family history or through their alternate sources, but it's not from somebody.
Human contact
and from the other side. Mm-hmm. Showed them pictures or slides of special places and a video about an encounter. And I talked about, Kula, about the projects that we did in school here about landscape of reconciliation. While there, a woman came to me and said, my parents are from Kula. And it was amazing. You know, it's like, so it brings those people and to talk about a place, and mm-hmm. this place has been dispossessed 62 years ago, and now, or 61 years ago, and now we are talking about it, and it's still as much as alive as it was back then. There is a song that Ethan brought with him by Yuri Gopher, and it is a powerful one. It's a very, very powerful song, and it is in both Hebrew and Arabic, and it has subtitles in English. And it talks about this little girl who was born on the sea, not knowing, in an apartment to a mother, a father, and a dog. And she doesn't know anything. She doesn't know that this place belonged to another people, mm-hmm. That they were displaced from it. She doesn't. And then he talks about that history and that pain. And this little girl comes and asks about the rubble that's there, and that you try to explain it away to her. And the imagery, how it moves between the little Jewish girl and the little refugee girl back and forth. And two powerful lines he kept repeating is that one is, that's because that's what all little girls do. You know, she'll take whatever you tell her and she will mm-hmm. go and because that's what they do. And then at the end, it's that that's a heavy burden. And I appreciated that he uses the Arabic too. And I heard Ethan said that he speaks to his little girl in Arabic too.
Earlier.
And it's just amazing. Uh-huh. And it is this, we are, with this encounter, with this, many people don't know that. And that, of course, when you see another person living in the place that is your place, constantly hearing about how you are being pushed away by them, you don't know this other narrative that about people who are really wanting to have a place for reconciliation, who really push as much as they can, who teach their kids about that history, and who wants, according to, that's one of the questions we got. I mean, so what do you do? And for next, acknowledgement is good, but what do we do next? And Ethan said it's not for us, for Zuchrot. We don't debate whether the refugees have a right to return or not. We say they have a right to return. Mm-hmm. Of course, we accept that. But now we visualize the possibilities. And that's what I've been working with them on, the ideas of what would it look like? And what would a place, just like what Ariella talks about, you know, this is a civil place for all its people, where people are equal. There isn't anybody, there is no system of mm-hmm. preference to mm-hmm. one group or from another. And so the third talk was, so the talk that was, the body language was sort of like closed in. There were tears on those faces. They clapped for us three times at mm-hmm. the end. It was just powerful. And it was the first time for Ethan to speak to this large group of girls, Muslim girls, all wearing their, you know, it's in that. And so it was a phenomenal, phenomenal talk. And the last talk was at DePaul University, and that's where Ali Abu Naima came and talked. And so we had three sessions, and I felt compelled to talk about, it's not, you know, the narrative. The year my brother was born was the year that Ethan immigrated with his family from Argentina to across the street from my home in that kibbutz. And so with one man from an older guy in the audience said, well, how do you even forgive when this gentleman was part of the Jewish Voice for Peace. And he said, how do you forgive when he's the one who kicked you out of there. It's like, it's not very easy, but it's with justice. There's a sense of justice about it, because there's who actually helped me find home.
Right.
And then when we have certain ways that we are looking at the world more in common, and then you think about the heavy burden. I think about my niece and nephews, and I want them to be in their home. But I also think about my friends' daughter and sons, and they need to be in their home too. And so that's very important. So we had, and there too, we found people from Kula. It's amazing. and it's not a huge place, by the way.
Say,
it's
how big was it?
I think it was about 2,000 people, perhaps, tiny. Or whatever. It's tiny. It's a small place, or village. Maybe a little bit more, I don't know. It was a village, but then, of course, the offsprings now are huge. We are humongous. We are more than 5 million people in diaspora.
Right.
And there, too, the idea about why is it, because we had an image, both of us sitting on top of the remains of my mom's home, why is it that people go and sit on top of the rubble? And it's you are mourning. So both of us were mourning that because there was silence. And we talked about how we know our history from before. Mm-hmm. We know about what happened after the Nakba. But then the things that happened during the Nakba, there is people want to go quickly over it. And I was asked why. And I think my response to it is that first people can't believe it happened to them. They are ashamed they let it happen to them. And apparently that is another parallel between that and other, the shame that I can't believe that we let this happen to us. But it's really very powerful. So all in all, to me, I felt like I found the people or the family and the friends. Yep.
Well, thanks, Rula. We're going to take a little music break here, cool. And we'll come back and talk some more with Rula before we conclude the program. We've got a little B.B. King now.
sing. Every man and woman, boy and girl, let's all get together, bring peace to the world. One more time. I hear it. Every man and woman, boy and girl, let's all get together, bring peace to the world. One more time. Let's feel it.
Okay, that was B.B. King and Rula. What do we have now for us?
Okay, well, actually, this is to go back about refugees and Ghassan Kanafani, who is he's one of the most amazing Palestinian writers. He died very young, actually. He wrote something about Palestine's children. And he himself, at the age of 16, took a job teaching at a United Nations Relief Agency, UNRWA school, in a refugee camp to help support his family as well as to continue his own education. So he talks about how two incidents while he was teaching are very indicative of his commitment and are the beginning of his beginning to notice that there are certain things that deal with Palestinian refugees that perhaps the rest of the world doesn't really understand or know. So he speaks about for example, he noticed that many of his young students were falling asleep during class. It angered him at first. Then he discovered that the children were working late into the night, selling sweets in the cinema or on the street to help support their families. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, you start thinking about the father is working if the father is alive. Right. The mother is working if she's alive. Everybody is trying to work or to, if they can work in whatever thing they can do. Mm-hmm. And so he said, I realized that the children's drowsiness did not stem from scorn for me or dislike for their studies, nor did it have anything to do with my capacity as a teacher. It was simply a reflection of a political problem.
Right.
And so that was really powerful statement. He also talks on another occasion how he was giving a lesson in accordance with the official curriculum. The curriculum called for the instructor to teach the children how to draw an apple and a banana. So he started drawing on the blackboard. All of a sudden, it occurred to him that these children have never seen either an apple or a banana because those things had no real bearing on their lives. He erased the drawing and asked them to draw pictures of the refugee camp instead. He later described that event as a decisive turning point in his life, saying, I clearly remember that precise moment among all things that have happened to me in my life. So, to me, when I read that, actually, it was really powerful how much we assume about the children that will be coming here.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of? I love that there are the ideas of art, because art and the request for art supplies,
sure,
and such, it becomes a way to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, the need to allow it to express what it needs to be expressed instead of, here's the curriculum, you have to draw such and
right,
such, you know.
Right.
I think that was really a powerful moment.
You know, and even as I'm thinking about books, sending books to kids, we have to be really sensitive,
exactly,
to what kinds of books.
Exactly.
I work in a place where there are books donated all the time, and we have, a while ago we sent crates to, I believe it was Africa, and we had to to see which ones were appropriate and which ones might be just plain insulting or so foreign to what kids' experiences are.
And words and images. Mahmoud Darwish, have you read any of his poems? Passed away a year ago. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So one of his poems from his book, Why Did You Leave the Horse Alone? And it talks a lot about this, the exodus of people from their villages and from their towns. He's from Liberia, and one of them is the Eternity of Cactus, Abadus Sabar. Arabic or English? Your choice. I will go English. Or I'll go in between the two.
Do a little bit of
a little bit. إلى أين تأخذني يا أبي؟ إلى جهة الريح يا ولدي. Where are you taking me, father? Where the wind takes us, my son. As the two were leaving the plain, where Bonaparte's soldiers surveyed the shadows on the old wall of Acre, a father said to his son, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid of the drone of bullets. Stay close to the ground so you'll survive. We'll survive and climb a mountain in the north and return when the soldiers return to their distant families. Who will live in the house after us, father? It will remain as it is, as it has always been, my son. ومن يسكن البيت من بعدنا يا أبي سيبقى على حاله مثل ما كان يا ولدي. He felt for his keys. He felt for his key the way he could feel for his limbs and was reassured, he said, as they climbed through a fence of thorns. Remember, my son, the British crucified your father on the thorns of a cactus for 2 nights, and he didn't confess. You will grow up, my son, and tell those who inherit this their guns the story of the blood upon the iron. Why did you leave the horse alone? To keep the house company, my son. Houses die when their inhabitants are gone. لماذا تركت الحصان وحيدا؟ لكي يؤنس البيت يا ولدي. فالبيوت تموت إذا غاب سكانها. Eternity opens its gate from a distance to the traffic of night. The wolves of the wilderness howl at the frightened moon. And a father says to his son, be strong like your grandfather. Climb with me the last hill of oaks, my son. And remember, here Janissary fell from the mule of war. So be steadfast with me and we'll return. متى يا أبي؟ غدا. وربما بعد يومين يا ابني. When, father? Tomorrow? Perhaps in 2 days, my son. A reckless tomorrow chewed at the wind behind them through the long nights of winter. وكان جهود يهوشع بالنون يبنون قلعتهم من حجارة بيتهما وهما يلحثان على درب قانا هنا. The soldiers of Yehoshua bin Nun built their citadel from the stones of their house. Out of breath on the path of Tukana, here Jesus passed one day. Here he turned water into wine and said many things about love. My son, remember tomorrow. Remember crusader citadels, gnawed at by April weeds after the soldier's departure.
Thanks, Rona.
You're welcome.
Good stuff. And we're going to exit here with little Bob Marley and the Wailers. This is Jerry Swenson and Sally Perrine for Peace Radio with our guest, Rula Awad Rafferty. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
And tune in again next week from 2 to 4 when Sally and Jill Maxwell will host Peace Radio. Remember that working for peace sometimes means raising a little hell. Well, get out there, make your voice heard, make your actions count, stir it up. Since I've got you.